Hello, James and Phil here from the Sunderland Echo. Today we're going to be bringing you something a little bit different. We're going to be having a look at Sunderland's most recent set of accounts. We know there's a head coach search ongoing, the upcoming transfer window, and the under-21s are in action in their Premier League 2 playoff quarterfinal. It is against West Ham tonight. We won't be talking through any of that today. That'll come later, hopefully. But Phil, we thought we'd drill down into some nice financial things.
Yeah, well, I think at the moment we're waiting for significant developments, I think would be the word to say, on sort of a new head coach and the retained list and all those sorts of things. So it seemed like a good moment actually to dip into something that I think is always a big talking point. And I think it's also a really interesting time to kind of take stock and have a look, not just at Sunderland's financial position, but also kind of what we've learned about how they're operating under this ownership. Because I think after two seasons in the Championship, there are so many questions about questions like ambition, sustainability, how close are Sunderland to getting to the Premier League? Can they get to the Premier League under this model? So it felt like while, you know, we've got a little bit of a breather while we wait for things to really start motoring in terms of next season, that, you know, it might be nice to and interesting to sort of have a chat about what we've kind of learned. First thing to say, obviously, is this is the accounts for Sunderland's first season back in the Championship. So, you know, the way the accounting reporting works, it's a year behind. So this is for the season that ended with, you know, Sunderland's defeat at Luton in the playoff semi-final. But it still tells us a hell of a lot, I think, about sort of where the club's at and where it's headed.
Yeah, absolutely. If you want some reading alongside this podcast or after this podcast, Phil covered Sunderland's accounts for last season. As he's just mentioned, that's the period that comes out every year. It's always a year behind. That's over on the Sunderland Echo website as well. I think Phil would both point towards Chris Weatherspoon, who has a probably far deeper understanding of finances in general than we could both ever hope to, is good reading as well. It also presents it really well on Twitter, and it's really easy to sort of digest, isn't it?
Absolutely essential reading. Definitely go and find Chris on Twitter. He'll kind of have all the information you need in a really sort of, like I say, easy to understand, easily digestible way, and kind of what we'll be doing is sort of picking on some of the threads of that really and trying to place it in a bit of context about where the club's at.
Indeed. So just looking at the accounts, when you sort of read them, you go through them, the headline that sort of jumps out straight away is that Sunderland made £9 million in losses. That was up from their last season in League One, as you'd expect. Now, on the face of it, Phil, you read that and you think, oh my God, £9 million, that's a lot of money. In terms of the Championship, though, it's not actually that uncommon. And I think Sunderland rank in the bottom five, actually, for losses. Just explain that sort of picture, because it's sort of a wider trend, isn't it, in terms of the Championship being a bit of a money pit, really.
It is a money pit. There's no other word for it. I think kind of the story of these accounts, really, is that Sunderland's revenues from going from League One to a Championship club meant that they benefited from a bit of extra TV money, a bit of extra ticket revenue, these kind of things. But that was significantly outstripped by the extra money they had to spend essentially on wages, not just players, general staffing as well, but obviously predominantly players. So that's basically a dilemma that all Championship clubs face. The revenues that they draw from the TV deal does not match what they need to spend on wages to compete with the teams who are benefiting parachute payments. And that is where we've seen so many teams in recent years get into huge financial trouble. Reading, Derby, probably the two main examples. There are clubs who've spent really heavily and managed to get promoted, which meant that those problems never came past. Bournemouth are an example of that. But that is obviously a huge risk. And so why £9 million is a huge loss, certainly would be a huge loss to me if I lost £9 million, and I suspect to most of our listeners. But the reality is, in the Championship context, it's a relatively set, solid set of results. It comfortably puts them in the bottom half. It was a long, long way off being one of the biggest losses in the division. And so in a strange sort of way, you know, Sunderland are a relatively stable financially, I would suggest, for the level. But I think it does just go to show it's the important context in terms of when we judge words like ambition. And we should always expect Sunderland to be very, very ambitious at this level. I'm not suggesting that for a second. We should expect the club of Sunderland size to be pushing towards the top end of the division. But the reality is that ambition at this level means writing off a huge amount of funds in the hope that it will enable you to get to the Premier League. But obviously there's no guarantees. And if you don't do that, you can begin to see why the levels of money that you're losing can cause you a world of pain. So I guess what this shows us is just what a difficult dilemma Championship clubs have. How far do you push it in order to try and get to the Premier League? How far do you push that risk?
I feel very split, Phil, on that issue that you've just mentioned. You know, a lot of fans would say that you need to speculate to accumulate. A lot of fans are quite happy for Sutton to sort of be run within the means. The caveat to that is it would be great if Sutton could capitalise a bit more on their commercial revenue. We'll come to that in a second. But Ipswich have shown maybe that you do have to spend a little bit of money to get out of the division. They've done, you know, marvellously well. On the flip side of that, look at Hull City, who've missed out on the playoffs, and now all of a sudden their owner's making a few rash decisions and a little bit of concern. So it is such a fine tightrope. And we've seen, really, when a club like Sunderland gets into a lot of debt in terms of the Ellis Short days, yes, he wrote that debt off, but it also came with a cost further down the line in terms of Sunderland's parachute payments being promised to Madrox. So I can sort of see both sides of the argument. What do you think this tells us about Kirilui Dreyfus Wansatori's intentions at the club?
Well, I think that what we expected in the first season back in the Championship was, when you put their sort of results into context of the Championship clubs, they weren't anywhere near one of the top spenders in the division, as you would expect, because obviously you have three teams who've just been relegated, so have parachute payments coming into the club. You also have another three or four who are still in receipt of parachute payments, so it may not be at the same level as those three relegated clubs, but they still have that advantage. We did see probably that Sunderland were a little bit more ambitious than we might initially have thought in their first season back in the Championship. So their wage bill actually grew fairly significantly. I suspect that's a combination of factors. One is obviously staffing levels. Going up a level means, you know, you increase your staffing. Yeah. One is players they obviously brought into the club lifted the wage bill. But I suspect what we also saw was a lot of players already in the squad saw their wages increase, whether that was being handed new deals because of their progress, or whether it was pre-existing clauses in their current deals that were automatically triggered by promotion. So what we should say is that Sunderland's wage bill very much placed them within the mid-table category, in terms of they were right in there with the teams who were spending at a level where they weren't competing with teams at the top. But you would look at it and think, well, they would expect a mid-table finish and hopefully push towards the top end of the table if they can. We know that after the season, Christian Speakman confirmed that internally the target had been a top-half finish. And while it undoubtedly significantly overachieved, I think that this probably did show that there was a relative level of ambition. I'm not saying, you know, they were spending as Ipswich did over the last 18 months to go straight back up, but there was a relative level ambition. What's going to be really interesting is when we throw this forward to next year and we see the accounts for this season, is will the wage bill have grown? Because I think a lot of fans would turn around and say, well, do you know what? I actually think pound for pound, that team that played Luton was a stronger team than the one that finished this season. And what and I suspect
also
next season...
Also got rid of a lot of the older players who might have been on a bit more money as well.
Exactly. So it'll be really interesting to see how much that wage bill has grown. If it has, I think there'll be in a very interesting debate about whether Sunderland have kind of got value for money in terms of, as you say, moving on those experienced players who are performing pretty well. And what I expect it will show is that Sunderland significantly underachieved this season and finishing 16th. So the accounts certainly tell us what we thought was that Sunderland are not sort of an Ipswich or a Hull, who I know Ipswich haven't spent a lot of in the way of fees this season, but in terms of wages and also the fees and wages that they spent to get out of League One meant that they were spending pretty heavily all round. So Sunderland are definitely not one of the biggest spenders in this division, that's true, but we shouldn't probably fall into the trap of thinking they're one of the very smaller spenders in this division, because that's absolutely not the case either. And that's kind of what what these set of accounts have kind of underlined for us, where the question is exactly what you say, is in terms of, can the money that started to come in from player sales, and we'll move this forward a little bit because I think it's really relevant to this point, which is that these accounts don't cover the deadline day business.
Yeah.
So the sales of Ross Stewart and Lyndon Gooch aren't included in these accounts. Now, that obviously will make a significant difference to Sunderland's financial position. Also not included are the acquisitions of Reeson, Pembele and Adil Aouchiche on deadline day as well. So that'll obviously offset the Stewart money a little bit. But broadly speaking, you would expect to see that Stewart money make a significant difference to Sunderland's accounts the next time they're released. And the really interesting question is, you know, it's kind of clear that Sunderland are going to have to, as you say, speculate to accumulate, especially in positions like striker, where we found they found it very, very difficult to find those sort of gems, if you like, that they got Ross Stewart. That increasingly feels like a bit of a one-off. And it feels it increasingly feels like it is going to cost a bit of a premium, really, to get those quality, that quality in those positions. And the big question, I think, moving forward is the money that starts to come in from the sale of Stewart, maybe it'll be a Jack Clarke this summer, who knows, maybe it'll be a different player. Will that allow them to sort of close the gap? And at the moment, I think that's where the sort of where the big question mark lies going into this summer window.
And we knew this already, Phil, but it does really underline that this way of doing things, this model, is based around ultimately player sales. And I don't mean player fire sales. I mean probably selling one player a summer for big money and reinvesting that.
Yeah, well, I think one of the really interesting things about these accounts is that there's two sides. One, I think it does underlie that if there isn't going to be persistently significant cash injections from the ownership, and they are putting cash into the club, these accounts, again, sure, they are putting money in to plug those losses, but it's not just the level of some other owners in the division. That is, is just a fact. And so it underlines the importance in that context of, for example, a Ross Stewart sale, which we expected eventually to earn something between, 8 and 12 million, depending on certain add-ons and what have you, in terms of closing that gap. The other thing that's really interesting from these accounts is they make a huge point. These accounts have come with some notes from the board, if you like, which I would recommend any fan to go and read. Last year, when the accounts were released, they basically revealed their plan to get to the Premier League in what is now another two seasons. And this one, they make a big point of saying how they really want to target increased commercial revenues. So they clearly feel, reading between the lines, at the moment, the club is not set up to maximise the revenue it can get off the pitch. I don't think that's any surprise to any Sunderland fan who has gone to buy someone a shirt for Christmas or a birthday or got some merch for a loved one and has found that experience quite frustrating.
Yeah.
So I think these accounts underline that they see that as an avenue where obviously it's not going to make up the level of losses we're talking about, but something that is really important to the business plan moving forward. And we've already seen, obviously, the Hummel deal announced, the Fanatics deal, to see Fanatics take over the retail side of the operation. This is obviously a really key part, trying to tap into that almost, trying to think of a better phrase for it, or that almost like US brand marketing, is something that they see as a really important part of how they're going to try and push the club a little bit closer to sustainability in the next few years. Obviously, David Breese was confirmed as the new Chief Business Officer, I think was the title he was given last Thursday or Friday. And it seems fairly clear to me that this is going to be a massive part of his remit. Given his experience with the MLS and in American sport, it seems like something to me that I get the impression Kirill really wants to push, because he feels that's something where the club's kind of been left behind a little bit at the moment. And we knew that. We talked about it a lot. When the new regime and new ownership came in, the focus was we have to get out of League One. So the investment was primarily put into the playing side, not just in the players, in all the stuff that goes around the players, the analysis, the data, the scouting, the recruitment team that was rebuilt. It has been a significantly longer process to start rebuilding the off-pitch stuff. And I think everyone who follows Sunderland or supports Sunderland has come across that at some stage. They've seen that rebuilding, if you like, whether it's through ticketing frustrations, whether it's through shop frustrations, whatever it is. So it's interesting to me that they're almost setting the stall out here to say that this is something that we're going to really step up over the next couple of years. And it's going to be interesting to see how much, sort of how good they make on that pledge and just how much we actually see that investment and whether we see a significant impact on that going forward.
It's funny, isn't it, just to go off on a little bit of a tangent, but so while I was listening to you speak there, I was sort of thinking, it's great that this Fanatics thing is coming now, this Hummel deal, all of this sort of stuff, and I hope that boosts the commercial revenue. And I think it's definitely an avenue that needs exploring, but why is it then taking them so long? But then when you said the priority of getting out of League One, it sort of made me think of Birmingham City in a way, and their American owners have come in and they've decided to change a lot and promise a lot as well, and ultimately they've ended up actually going backwards on the field as well. And it sort of feels like that was the main priority of Sunderland's ownership when they came in. You could argue that they've gone significantly backwards on the field in the past 12 months, but it seems like that's always been their primary focus, Phil. And and whether you agree on the timescale or not, now they're getting around to some of the aspects of the club that have been a little bit neglected over the years.
Yeah, and obviously one of the significant things that has happened since the period which these accounts cover is obviously we know that there's going to be a huge investment in the stadium alike. And that's going to have a significant impact on the club financially because of the scale of works that is actually required to refresh the stadium line and bring it back up to where it needs to be. So that's going to be a significant, I don't want to use the word drain because that's probably a little bit dramatic, but that's going to have a significant impact on the sort of accounts that we see in a year or 2 years' time. So I think you're absolutely right. And it also raises another interesting question, I think, as well as when we talk about those commercial revenues and all these kind of things. Well, that obviously depends on an element of feel-good factor.
Oh, absolutely.
If you want your fans to be hyper-engaged, spending their money, which they are very happy to do when they feel enthusiastic, when the product's good. And when I say when the product's good, I don't just mean the little product, as in the retail and all those kind of things. And of course, that's very important. But they need to feel engaged with what's happening on the pitch. And that's where there's this really interesting balance, which is what we keep going back to. Where is the financial balance between investing to put a team that can compete at the top end of the pitch, playing a really aggressive, good-to-watch style of football that will ensure that your ticketing levels remain where they are, which remain absurdly high, really, given the relative lack of success over the last decade. And it also makes people feel engaged in a way that they then want to go and spend their money and sort of invest in the club, if you like. So again, that's like a really interesting question for me in terms of, you know, I think we know that some of them want to do things sustainably. They're not going to invest rashly. They're not going to invest in a huge way. But it's at what point do you then begin to threaten what you really need, which is that kind of unity, if you like, or that buy-in is maybe a better word for it. And I suspect this season or over the last 18 months, maybe that balance hasn't quite been there, I think is probably fair to say. And that represents a really interesting sort of challenge going forward.
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it, really, Phil, that you talk about the enthusiasm and relying on that for commercial success. It's a year ago today since Sunderland beat Luton Town in the playoff first leg semi-final at the Stadium of Light. I'm mad with that lovely goal coming back from a goal behind, and the enthusiasm around the club at that point, whereas the commercial offering wasn't too good, and these changes have come maybe it's a little bit too late in Sunderland fans' eyes. I'm sure they'll see the benefits eventually. I guess, Phil, as well, and we are going off piece a little bit here, we'll come back to the accounts in a second, but I guess a lot of Sunderland fans would argue that incremental investment is good, running, you're sort of walking before you can run and all that sort of stuff. But you look at maybe the opportunity Sunderland had last season and the squad they had last season, the division the way it was last season, had they just turned the dials a little bit further around in January perhaps, or maybe even the previous summer, then Sunderland, you know, could have had a real chance this season. It's what ifs and maybes, isn't it? But I guess that, as you say, is the balancing act that Sunderland are striving to find.
Yeah, it's a funny one, that, isn't it? I mean, I think the business in last summer window, not summer, the summer before last, when
it was good, was good.
I think it was a pretty solid window, wasn't it, in terms of adding Ahmad, although he came in and sort of took him a while to get going, adding Ellis Sims up front with Ross Stewart. Pretty unlucky, to be honest, not to get Nathan Broadhead. I know there's always a lot of discussion about Nathan Broadhead. I think people forget that they did actually agree a deal to sign him permanently. Broadhead decided not to take it at that time. By the time January then rolled around, it was a very, very different deal because Ipswich had entered the equation. And we all have a sense, I think, of how aggressively they were spending at that time. So I think that's like an important caveat. The January one is definitely a different one. You know, Gelhardt was a significant signing. You know, we shouldn't forget that he was, you know, one of the more expensive loans coming down from the Premier League at that time. You know, the idea was for him to play with Stewart, which obviously would have been a very different proposition. But you're absolutely right in what you say. And it's going to be a debate, I think, we have next January. It's going to keep coming round, you know, is what is the balance between pushing it that little bit further? Listen, if Sunderland had pushed the boat out, maybe it would have always gone to Ipswich. So maybe it's a little bit moot. But let's say theoretically, if Sunderland had gone to the level they had to land Kiefer Moore in January, you know, maybe they would have snuck in the playoffs, and then who knows? The flip side of that is maybe they wouldn't, and maybe then they would have finished 10th and they would have eaten up a huge amount of their budget on a striker that was then going back to his parent club. So there's no really easy answer, is there? I think that's the top and bottom of it. There's two aspects to it, really. One is that it feels as if there needs to probably be a slight shift in certain areas of the pitch where I think they are going to have to invest. I think that's obvious. The other thing is that the major issue this season, as we've seen, has not just been investment. It's been that the decision-making hasn't been as good. That's really what these accounts show. Because although Sunderland did spend relatively well at this level, they overachieved because they made good recruitment decisions. They picked up Ahmad, who other teams weren't particularly interested in because it hadn't worked at Rangers, but they were able to spot the talent and put him with a head coach who gave them loads of confidence. They made good decisions. Tony Mowbray was an outstanding appointment. And I think if us would hold our hands up and say we weren't really that fussed at the time after Alex Smith had left, perfect manager for the squad in the situation. Do you know what I mean? So they were able to bridge some of that gap through shrewd decision making. This season was the opposite, where actually, you know, they were, I would imagine, we'll see when the accounts come out next year, but I would imagine they were again spending at a mid table level, possibly up a mid table, but they made bad decisions that then meant they underachieved. You know, obviously, the way a decision to sack Tony Mowbray when they did and then bring in Michael Beale. So while definitely I think everything we've seen shows the need for ongoing investment, what we should also say is these accounts show us the value of good decision making. And that more than anything has been the problem this season, that decision making has not been of the level that we'd seen it at in the previous 18 months.
No, absolutely. A couple of quick talking points to run through before we wrap up. A lot is said about financial fair play, Phil. What is Sunderland's situation? It's sort of the go-to answer, isn't it, on social media of why clubs in the Championship shouldn't spend more, is the financial restrictions. And that obviously you don't want to fall afoul of that. We've seen, you know, points deductions not only in the Championship but the Premier League as well. So it's an issue across football. How does Sunderland fit into that?
Yeah, the reality is that compared to most of their rivals, Sunderland's financial fair play position is incredibly strong. So the current rules in place limit Championship clubs to losing £13 million a season over 3 years. So basically, your last 3 years of financial results, you can't lose any more than £39 million or you're in breach of the regulations. Now, obviously, we don't have these years' accounts because they're not publicly available. So we don't know exactly what the position is now because it'll be based on what Sunderland have made or lost this season. But if you look at the last 3 years that we do have on record, we can see that they're very comfortable. They lost £9 million last year, which is well under that £13 million. They lost £5 million the year before, which is well under the limit. And I think it was a loss of around £11 million the year before that, which was also COVID impacted. And there were certain exceptions in place for that. So Sunderland are way, way under the level, the upper limit, and that's even before you bring in that COVID season. So there's absolutely no two ways about it. Sunderland could invest a lot more in the playing squad if they wanted to. Financial fair play currently is not a concern for Sunderland, and the wriggle room in wages and fees is absolutely there. I know what Sunderland's argument with that to be was that it would only make two or three bad sort of £5 million signings, if you like, wages, and all of a sudden those losses increase very quickly, and then you are in trouble. But the facts are very clear that they're in a comfortable financial fair play position. We don't know how long those actual current regulations are going to be in place, because people will be aware from following the Premier League that they're planning to vote in a new set of regulations, which will be based on turnover, and basically it'll be back to the old system that Sunderland had in League One, where you're capped, what you can spend on wages can only be a certain percentage of your turnover. Now, we expect once the Premier League vote to bring in their new rules, the Championship will also have a vote to bring in new regulations. So I expect, maybe not for next season, but the season after, I think we'll be operating with a different financial regulation anyway, whereby Sunderland's turnover becomes even more important because what they can spend is based on that. That again underlines why all that commercial stuff is so important, because that's going to be building the ceiling from which you can then invest in your wages. But in terms of where Sunderland are right now going into the summer window, if Kirill and Wansatori decided they wanted to go that way, you know, the room is absolutely there to invest in the squad. That much is very, very clear.
Just spitballing here, Phil, but which financial system do you reckon benefits Sunderland the most? The way it is now, or if we went back to a sort of salary cap sort of rule that we had in League One? Because I remember in League One, that was the argument, wasn't it? That under the under the current rules in League One, Sunderland should have been doing a lot better because the turnover was so much greater than any League One club, really. But in the Championship, a little bit more of a level playing field. There's rivals in there, obviously, yeah. Leeds this season and stuff like that. There are, you know, big beasts in the Championship as well as Sunderland.
Well, I think it's a quite difficult. In theory, it kind of depends on the intention of the ownership. In theory,
yeah.
The current rules should work relatively well for them because they've benefited from the cost cutting of the previous regime, which has meant that their base in terms of the losses is very, very low. So whereas a lot of teams happen to be quite careful so as not to infringe those limits, Sunderland actually don't really have those concerns. So you could make a case that if you wanted to have a gamble and roll the dice, and we've talked about all the reasons why that's incredibly risky, but if you wanted to, you could argue that these regulations currently suit Sunderland very well because they don't have the same level of concerns that the clubs do. In principle, I think in time, they would probably favour the kind of model we're talking about, because we say every week we talk about Sunderland having the biggest attendances in the league. If they're able to maximise that revenue through those commercial things we talk about, if they're able to start steadily bringing in significant income from the odd sale of a player in every other window or what have you, then theoretically they should be in a really good position to start investing quite heavily in the wage bill and start to cut the gap to those teams with parachute payments. But there's a lot of unknowns moving forward. I mean, I think there's a couple of things that are worth mentioning. One is, you know, we still don't know if there's going to be a new financial settlement between the Premier League and the EFL. People will have been following this, that this is being tied up with the independent regulator, which is potentially going to come in at some point, and whether that's going to affect the money that gets distributed through the pyramid. And it may also mean there's a renegotiation of parachute payments. We don't know that. That would be a huge sort of game changer, really. And that is something that would definitely benefit Sunderland. If the parachute payments were overhauled and money started to be distributed on a more sort of level basis, then that's a real game changer for Sunderland. As of yet, there's no concrete indications of that happening because the Premier League clubs are very, very resistant to it. One thing we do know is definitely changing is that from next season, and people will have started to read about this, is there's going to be a new TV deal. The short-term impact of this is lots more games on TV, lots more rescheduling, but hopefully with more advanced notice. But I do think that's going to be worth, judging by the initial estimates, I think that's probably going to be worth a couple of million quid every season to Championship clubs. What's going to be interesting is, do the clubs use that to help cut the losses they're making, or is it just going to inflate wages more? Is a bit more money, a bit more cash in Championship clubs, is that just going to go straight into players' wages and players' fees and agent fees? Or is it going to be a little bit of a tool for most of the clubs to go, actually, we can sort of move a little bit closer to sustainability, because it is going to be, like I say, it will be worth at least, I think, about 1.5 million to each Championship club next year. So that's going to be a really interesting sort of thing going forward as well. In the long run, I think it's more to answer your question. I think a change in distribution and the change in regulations might serve something quite well. But at the moment, it's probably preventing a lot of ambitious owners in this division spending at the level they would like to. So I think you could make an argument at the moment that the current rules probably suit Sunderland in their current guise, because I suspect there are some clubs who are being hamstrung a little bit by the money that they've spent in the past.
It's a crazy old topic, this, isn't it, Phil? Just football finance in general. It is such a hard thing to sort of grasp in its entirety. I mean, the ground you've covered there, TV money, commercial income, player sales, ambition of owners, you know, salary caps, financial fair play. It is bonkers, isn't it? It really is a minefield.
I think we've seen how important it's sort of grown to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
And obviously, even to be honest, even less so in the Championship than in the Premier League this season, really, where, you know, it looked like for a while like relegation would essentially be decided off the field, didn't it? Three points, why have you? Now, as it happens, that isn't the case. I think what we're seeing really is the gap between the Premier League and the Championship is widening financially. That's a fact. It's becoming harder than ever, really, to bridge that gap. And it's also interesting in the case of Sunderland, really, in that sort of we were very lucky, James, of our generation, that when Sunderland were in the Championship, they were always pretty much going to be right up there, because that was the end of the era, really, where having a huge fan base, steadily large crowds, pretty much guaranteed that you were going to be able to spend at a level to get out of the Championship and hopefully compete at Premier League level. That didn't always happen in Sunderland's case, as we know, because they had a couple of absolutely wretched record-breakingly bad seasons. But we're now moving into an era where really attendances, financially, they're helpful.
And not as important.
It just pales in comparison to the TV revenues of the Premier League. And that's why, you know, you have an EFL that is packed with some of the biggest, most famous, sort of most historic clubs in England, because those old sort of financial streams are less important. And that's why you have, you know, what we would describe as fairly small clubs able to thrive and compete in the Premier League. Because if you can get up there and stay there, the revenue streams mean that your fan base is irrelevant to a large extent. So it's really important, I think, I suppose, is the point I'm trying to get to in a long-winded way, is to not just think within the Sunderland bubble, and to put Sunderland, which I think we're all guilty of, you know, seeing things through very like Sunderland lens, putting them in the context of the wider game. And there's loads of clubs that are experiencing what Sunderland are now, which is recognising that just having a big crowd doesn't mean financially you're on a footing with a lot of your championship rivals, especially if they have parachute payments. And that's still a challenge going forward. And that obviously doesn't mean that we shouldn't expect someone to be ambitious and that we shouldn't expect them to be pushing, because we absolutely should. But it is definitely a talking point that the once, you know, the financial parameters of the game have changed so dramatically, even in the last 10 years, never mind the sort of last 20.
No, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about debt. I think this is a really important issue, especially to Sunderland fans. Goes back to what I mentioned earlier about Ellis Short, who saddled the club with quite a bit of debt to himself. He ended up writing that off, but it came at a cost. Sunderland's debt has risen. It's debt to Kiri-Louis Dreyfus and Juan Satori. What have they said about the debt? Should fans be concerned about it?
Yeah, it's a really difficult one to answer. We're moving well beyond my areas of expertise. I think what we can say is there's a couple of factors here. One is that this debt is very, very different to the bulk of the debt that grew under Ellis Short. So when Sunderland's debt was beginning to get to a huge level while Ellis Short was in charge, part of that debt was to Ellis. Part of that debt was to an external body. I can't remember exactly what the organisation was called. But that's the debt that accrues interest. So when you have that, it costs you a lot more money because you have to pay it back with interest. The money to the owners is less concerning because you know that they're basically, you know, benevolent. They're gifting that money to a large extent, and also you're not paying interest on it. Now, as it happened, Ellis decided to pay all of the debt off when he left the club. So it wasn't just the debt that was owed to him. He also paid off the external debt. Now, you know, that realistically was a decision that gave Sunderland a fighting chance of battling back from where they were from. We know it wasn't quite as clear as that now because of the parachute payment issues, which we have not got time to go back into. But the reason I've raised that example is because it is important to note that this is debt to the ownership. So it's not debt that Sunderland are paying interest on. It's not debt that is going to drain the club's financial resource over the next few years. And that's a really important point. Where I guess there is always a level of concern is what's been said, not just in this set of accounts, but the previous set of accounts, is that they've consistently said that they will convert this debt to equity. Basically, it's as good as sort of writing it off, if that makes sense. They've said that a couple of times and they haven't yet done it. Only they can answer why that hasn't happened. I don't think it's an uncommon practice. I don't think it is a major concern because, as I say, because there's no interest on it, you know, it means that the club isn't being drained by that sort of decision not to convert it yet. But if you're someone who, you know, has some reservations over the ownership because of what initially happened with the shared disclosure and certain things like that, you know, then you might look at it and say that you're quite concerned that something, again, that's been said is going to happen, hasn't yet happened, is a concern. So it kind of depends where you fall on that one, to be honest. But the one thing, you know, that we should say, because it's entirely factual, you know, is that it is different to, you know, a loan to an external body where you're paying interest and you could potentially not just harm your future revenue, but it sort of could get you into trouble in certain circumstances where, you know, because often it might be debt that's guaranteed against the stadium or the academy alike. We've seen things like that in the past. That's absolutely not the case in this scenario as it stands. So I could certainly see why some fans would have reservations over it. But it's important to know that it is different to some of the debt that we've talked about at Sunderland in the past has been, you know, has been very concerning.
To get out of the Championship, Phil, Sunderland are probably going to, well, they are going to have to compete against clubs coming down from the Premier League with parachute payments. Obviously, we've talked a little bit about that in this podcast. How does Sunderland compete with those clubs? Obviously, it's the club's stated aim to get back to the Premier League. Judged on these accounts, what will Sunderland do in the future and how can they bridge that gap? Obviously, it's not a hard and fast rule that clubs that come down with parachute payments go straight back up. Sometimes they go straight back down, as we've seen as Sunderland fans. So it's not a hard and fast rule, but it does help to have, you know, 35 million in your back pocket.
It just time just continuously shows what an absolutely spectacularly bad, historically bad season that was, beyond all belief and precedent. Staggeringly bad that season.
It's got to be the worst season of any Championship club ever. I mean, I'm sure there's some other.
It has to be right up there. I'm sure there's other clubs that would be up there. Yeah. But it is one of the great, great dismal seasons, really, for so many reasons.
Maybe it's Leeds when they went down to League One, but
Yeah. Anyway, I've sort of got sidetracked there. I think we've talked really about how Sunderland view it in terms of how they would like to do it. One thing is those kind of, well, I suppose the developing young talent, I guess, has two reasons or two goals. One is that you eventually develop a player who is as good as the player who is playing in a parachute payment team who's cost a lot of money. So I suppose you could argue that Dan Neil is maybe a season away from being a central midfielder, every bit as good as a central midfielder in the, for argument's sake, Burnley side that's just dropped out of the Premier League. The other aspect then, of course, is if you then decide to score at the Premier League, you get a lot of money for it, which you can then reinvest in the team. So that's one side of it. The second side of it is, as we've talked about, is driving those commercial revenues. So maybe if a team comes out of the Premier League or a team is in pushing towards the top of the Championship and they have a parachute payment advantage, but maybe they won't have the level of fan base that you do. And maybe you can begin to turn that into your advantage by having a really good commercial operation. So that's clearly somewhere where Sunderland see potential for growth. But we have to say they're a long way off, I think, being able to realistically turn that into a point where they can compete financially with parachute payment clubs. And obviously the main thing they have to do is they have to make much better decisions than they have this season. If you don't have that level of revenue, then you have to be the team making consistent good decisions. And they did do that for a while, and they haven't done this yet. And that's kind of been their biggest problem, really. You know, the examples of Brentford and Brighton are a little bit not quite right in terms of both of those clubs had huge owner investment. You know, Tony Bloom at Brighton and Matthew Bentham at Brentford invested a lot of money into those clubs, and we should not, you know, the Moneyball thing, it's kind of accurate to an extent, but we should not assume that that was all sustainable. Yeah. You know, there was a huge amount of owner injection and that probably underlines that it has to be a balance. But it's also a reality that they were the clubs, certainly in Brentford cases, who were making consistently better decisions than everybody else. And that's what we need more than anything else from Sunderland this summer. There needs to be a level of owner investment. We probably need to see them acknowledge that Ross Stewart, there aren't many of them around, and maybe you have to push the boat a little bit further to get that more established option. But fundamentally, they need to appoint a good head coach. They need to make a better decision than other teams appoint head coaches. They need to make better recruitment decisions than other teams. They need to sign the best. They need to make the best loan decisions, which they made good ones the season before this one, but not so good ones this time. So I think that's, you know, as big a lesson as anything, really.
Absolutely. Football finances are an absolute minefield, and I'm going to ask you a nice binary question, Phil. Sunderland's latest set of accounts, are they good or are they bad? I will allow you to caveat it because I know you're dying inside.
I think we should see them as good to a large extent, and that, you know, this was a club in a very, very, very severe state of financial distress for quite a long time. Now, the fact that they've lost £9 million means they are still in an element of financial distress, because pretty much any other business in the world, you'd be saying, obviously, that's an atrocious set of results. But the reality is they are not, you know, they are not one of the worst off financial teams in the Championship financially. They're not. And there is a way in which they have a platform really from which to grow, and that their losses are modest by Championship standards. They have talent in the squad, which could potentially bring in revenue in the future. They still have a huge, a huge fan base that is very well engaged and would like to be more engaged. I think most would like to be able to spend more money on the club. And so I think there is definitely sort of grounds for optimism within these results. But obviously it's about maximising it, isn't it? It's about how does the club build on this platform?
And intent, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And we shouldn't allow what has been a wretched second half of the season to make us think that everything at the club is wrong, because it's not. And these accounts show us some of certain these things. And that in this campaign that we're talking about, you know, they overachieved because they made good decisions. They overachieved because they had good academy players who were thriving. So I definitely think, relatively speaking, you know, I do think it's a good set of accounts, but that's kind of worthless if you don't capitalize on that opportunity by really taking things to the next level and now really making some good football decisions, you know, especially the means you can sort of benefit from some of the work that's gone on. But yeah, listen, the simplest way to put it is we could have sat here many, many other years and talked about a considerably worse set of accounts than this one. Maybe that's the sort of the best way to put it, is that, you know, it's a different something to what we were talking about, you know, maybe any time between 5 and 15 years ago. Whether people see that as a huge positive, I don't quite know. But I think that's probably the fairest answer I can give you on that one.
And just on that point as well, Phil, do you feel that there's, I know every club has to publish their accounts yearly, and there's little place to hide really, but you get the impression that maybe there's a little bit more transparency around a lot of the big issues now. Perhaps Kirilluie Dreyfuss has maybe learned his lesson from the shareholder initial claim that he was majority when he was in fact a minority. I know he was a majority controlling owner, but there's a lot of stuff that's happened obviously with Donald and Methven back in the day, but I do get the feeling now that there's sort of no skeletons in the closet anymore, which is quite nice.
Yeah, I think there's to an extent, I definitely think we should and can push for a lot more accountability. Neither of the club's ownership really are available
to stop asking
questions from the media, and they've been not hugely accessible to fans either, I would suggest. I know Kirill has attended meetings with the support collective, which is good. I've been at a Q&A that he's done with supporters, which was very good. But I would argue they've been quite rare and not frequent enough. So I don't feel that Sunderland are as transparent and as accountable as they should be and as they could be. But I agree with you that, you know, these, certainly the last couple of sets of accounts they've put out have been a lot more transparent than previous ones. You know, certainly the notes that accompany them, which again, you know, people want to go and read them, they give you a bit more insight into, you know, the plans and what the club's planning and where they see things than what we used to have. So I agree with your point. There is definitely more transparency than we've had in the past. But I would like to kind of see more and also in between accounts. I think we could certainly expect and demand a lot more.
Oh, brilliant. We've gone 43 minutes there, Phil. So thank you very much for that. A very, very all-encompassing topic. Thank you very much for watching. Phil, you've written about this over at the Sunderland Echo. People can go and read that. What else are you writing about at the moment? I'll have to put you on the spot there. Is the answer nothing?
It's a good question. I'm currently writing about all the transfer decisions that have been made in the last couple of windows. I'm looking at which ones worked, which ones didn't, rating them. Mainly to actually see what needs to change going into next season and what went wrong after a really good season, the one before. We also have the big under-21s game tonight. Our colleague Joe is going to be at that game, so there'll be extensive coverage for that. That's going to be a really big occasion for the under-21s. We expect, as the week develops, there'll be potentially some retain list news. There may be some head coach developments, although we're still sort of waiting for concrete stuff on that. So there is going to be loads of stuff coming, but the reality is that we are a little bit beholden to Sunderland. So let's see what Sunderland have in store And then we will sort of be reacting to that. But listen, we're going to have loads of videos, aren't we, and stuff. We're going to do one retained list. We'll chat about the squad and how it's looking. When the new head coach is in, we'll do some stuff around that. So, yeah, definitely subscribe to the YouTube page and stay tuned, because we are going to be doing loads of stuff as the summer develops. We're certainly not going anywhere, are we?
No, we're not. And dare I say, this is a little bit of a lull, a little bit of a calm before the inevitable incoming storm, which is about to hit us at some point, which we look forward to. Thank you for watching on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, X, as it's now known. You can find this podcast on all podcast platforms shortly after the end of this broadcast. And it's also available on Shots TV later on Freeview. Thank you very much for listening to the Raw Podcast.